Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller, and I'd like to apologize in advance for the stuffiness you will hear today. I have the coronavirus and shall soon be dead, but I'm still dedicated to bringing you this very important podcast. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Not infected with coronavirus.
I'm pretty good.
That's good. That's good. Good for you. Good for you. Before we get started on this week's show, I want to tell you all a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report, but for Hollywood. And after you are done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you'll stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. We just wrapped up Wahlberg Week. Mark Wahlberg. He got a whole week from us. And it included some pretty great pieces on the decidedly American cinema of Peter Berg and Mark Wahlberg. And we also had an essay up that was just a fantastic look at Warrior ahead of the release of The Way Back, about which we will have more to say in a moment or two. We are paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access to the site, either $2 per month or $20 for the whole year. That is less than most Patreons, and you get so much more bang for your buck. And now on to the show. Up first in controversies and controversies. We're all going to die. Specifically me, specifically from coronavirus.
Wait,
as
Sonny.
As you can hear today.
We don't have time to die. I thought that
we
was
do.
The whole...
We do,
no, there's literally no time to die.
We do.
But is
Peter,
it,
stop interrupting. This is hard enough for me as it is.
Isn't
stop
this a
interrupting.
Double negative? We don't have no time to die because no time to die has been bumped due to the coronavirus. All right. Dad humor. I've been canceled. Let's just end the podcast right now.
But everyone else is going to die too. At least that's what the movie business fears. As Chinese theaters remain closed, costing the industry billions in global revenue, and studios pull out of events around the world, South by Southwest is losing people left and right. The Cannes Film Festival, I think, is either canceled already or on the verge of cancellation. A bunch of Comic-Cons are having guests pull out. Basically any event where tons of people get together in an enclosed space to cough and sneeze on one another, the industry is deeply spooked, so much so that MGM has done something that is almost unprecedented. They have pulled the new Bond movie, No Time to Die, which we just riffed on for 20 seconds. Thank you, guys. Not because it's a mess of a picture, probably, but because they're worried about the box office revenue just not being there because audiences just won't be there. The movie had been scheduled for a release in April, but it has been pushed back to November. Peter, what do you plan on watching on all of the streaming services while we wait to die?
I'm going to watch The Irishman again and again and again. And then I'm going to think about Martin Scorsese's op-ed about the value of the cinematic, of the theatrical experience for movies. Because here's a guy who, we've talked about this on the show before, but here's a guy who, you know, is one of our great filmmakers and who has really invested himself in the idea that seeing movies in person with other people matters. And then, of course, he made his latest opus for a streaming service. And so this is kind of what I'm seeing here as a possibility. We have all these streaming services, not just Netflix, but Amazon, and we've got, Hulu has expanded themselves with a partnership with FX. We've got, HBO actually expanding into this HBO Max thing. We've got Disney Plus. We've got the Peacock, whatever that is. We've got Quibi. We've got all of these.
Quibi.
Everybody knows about
that. Quibi.
Who could forget Quibi? Right. And we've got all these services now that are popping up all kind of right around the same time. And exactly at the moment when people are either because they're going to be forced to or because they're going to be encouraged to, going to spend, it looks like, over the next couple of months, much less time leaving their house and much more time at home. And so in obviously this is, first of all, it's bad for public health. It's bad for the economy. It's bad specifically for movies, for movie studios that rely on money from theatrical presentation and rely specifically from box office grosses from China. On the other hand, this looks like it could be something that it could be a boon for streaming services and for production that is designed for streaming services and for people, who are for homebodies who just want to stay home and watch The Irishman again and again and again.
And it's fascinating this happens at a time when all of these streaming services were launching such that there was, I think, a sense in industry reporting that there was possibly a little bit of a glut here,
yeah.
Right? I mean,
Well, even before there was a glut, nobody quite knew how Netflix was going to make money in the long run.
Right. But even more so, people didn't understand how consumers were going to make decisions about this. Because if you have to spend $13 a month on Netflix, $7.99 or whatever it is I'm paying for Disney Plus and HBO Max, and I mean FX, which has actually been sort of a little bit of an industry leader in terms of assessing some of these trends, had pulled back its exclusive streaming service, kind of bundled itself with Hulu, decided that that was not a viable line of business for them because they didn't feel like they could be yet another sort of three Starbucks Frappuccinos worth of people's money that they were going to be willing to shell out in streaming entertainment. And now all of a sudden there's been this phenomenon that at least temporarily may get people in the door on some of these streaming services. And so, you know, you see in some of the trade industry reporting, the studios that aren't packaged as part of larger conglomerates or the theatrical chains that aren't part of larger conglomerates stand to be in some considerable trouble, especially as the calendar gets reshuffled. But the companies that are part of larger entities that have multiple lines of business, to a certain extent, you know, speaking totally cynically as if there's no other impact of this, coronavirus may end up helping a piece of the entertainment industry that was perhaps sort of a gold rush or a folly.
So I think there's two possibilities here. No. One is, maybe there are sort of the spectrum of possibilities here. One is that this film, No Time to Die, was unusually vulnerable to this sort of shock. The last James Bond film, Spectre, made $679 million globally and only $200 million in the United States. It's the global box office that's driving James Bond's revenues, and it's the global box office that is really at risk right now. Movie theaters in the United States are still open. It's pretty clear that people are starting to stay home already, at least in some cities. But in China, movie theaters are not open right now. And right. So if you're looking ahead at a product that is primarily designed to be sold in China and then in other countries, that is a big problem for James Bond movies specifically. And so maybe James Bond is a one-off. On the other hand, if this snowballs and we see in the United States, even if it's just in a couple of big metro areas, because my understanding is that sort of outside of some of the kind of very densely populated coastal areas, there's less sort of panic buying. There's less of the kind of stuff people are reacting less strongly to the potential threat of coronavirus. But even if that's the case only in a couple of places in the United States, if it snowballs, we see sort of, let's even call it self-quarantining, right? I'm not talking about big government restrictions. I'm talking about people just deciding to go out a lot less. Then that is going to be a huge problem for theatrical distribution, which has been under threat for years, and more so from the Netflixes of the world. And I wonder, the big question to me is this going to be the death knell for theatrical distribution and for seeing movies in the theaters.
This is the think piece equivalent of panic buying toilet paper.
Right.
I think you are very much overestimating the amount of actual panicking we're seeing.
So hold on. I did say James Bond could be a one-off.
And what we're actually seeing from people, because it's interesting, the owner of Cineworld, which owns Regal and some other theater chains in Northern America, has seen no drop off in domestic ticket sales. Now they're the stuff overseas. Obviously, this is a problem. And when you have the state actually shutting theatrical exhibitors down and saying you can't have more than 100 people in a space, so you know theaters aren't going to be open. Obviously, that's a different sort of thing. But I do think that there are two possibilities. One is that this is the black swan event that actually ends up killing theatrical presentation, right? That this is a unforeseen, random occurrence that pushes everything over a tipping point. And the other is that this is a kind of a fad, if you will. And I think honestly, and I say this again, as somebody who is sitting here with probably just a cold, but thinking all the time, what if I have coronavirus? I don't think that a bad flu, which is what this essentially is the sort of thing that is going to get people in America to stop going to the movies. I just don't.
The thing that I think is a more legitimate, modest worry is that the movie business is not necessarily a high margin business overall, right? I mean, if you're Disney, you know, you're releasing a couple billion dollar movies a year, you're making a lot of money. But if you are an independent studio without, you know, larger sort of corporate cushioning in an economy like this, and you get a couple of your modestly budgeted productions that either have to be shut down for a while or end up getting canceled because you run out of time, or you have a couple of things tank, you know, where you could see the real impact of this is on sort of smaller, more vulnerable studios. And at a time when independent, interesting cinema is at risk, we may not see the death of the theatrical experience. People are still theoretically going to go see the next Star Wars movie in 4K and see what the hell happens with Emperor Palpatine's clones. But, you know, no.
Never. Never again. Never again.
Hashtag Star Wars reveals. The coronavirus was a no. I think the threat is a little bit different, and I don't think you're completely wrong here. But if you are a maker of movies, especially of modestly budgeted content, then you are gonna in any environment where we still have a world with an economy, then in any sort of reasonably non-apocalyptic situation, you're still gonna have platforms through which to distribute and charge money for your movies, because we have a really advanced on-demand economy right now. The people who are the businesses that are at most risk are the exhibitors, and that's the big theater chains, but even more than that, the little theater chains, and in particular the little theaters that do revival screenings, that do like little sort of mini festivals, that are putting on like let's have Scorsese night on, you know, like the Angelica that we just saw the way back at, right? So I mean, maybe not Angelica, but like those little exhibitors are who is going to be squeezed the most, and they are already having huge trouble, in part because of some of the stuff that Disney's doing with vaulting up Fox Films. That's a rough business for them, because they just don't have a lot of room to sort of weather 6 months of people deciding not to go to the movies.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the movie business is going to die. I think that what might either die or get hurt is what makes movies interesting. You know, the stuff at the edges, that's where I think we see the real potential for damage. But, you know, and we talk a lot about blockbusters and big movies on this podcast.
I think this is almost exactly backwards, though, because the movies that are in the most trouble are the movies that rely on places like China for their revenue.
Well, I'm saying if coronavirus takes off in the United States,
if it actually cripples the American economy in a real way, then right. I think the movie industry and the domestic film industry will obviously be in trouble.
But it'll also be the least of our problems.
I think Sonny may be onto something here. There is a possibility in which coronavirus kills the Disney film model, because the Disney film model is not make a bunch of $5 million movies or $20 million movies. It's make a very small number of $200 million movies that have to make a ton of money in China.
Well, and we talked about No Time to Die, but we haven't talked about Mulan, which is shaping up to be a potential really huge disaster for Disney, not because the release date is getting moved altogether, but because so far Disney has preserved the domestic release date in the United States while sort of infinitely suspending the Chinese release date. This is a movie where they spent $200 million to make a movie that's very specifically designed to appeal to Chinese audiences. I mean, there is this huge feature in the Hollywood Reporter about how much effort the director and the star have gone to you know, research all of the cultural background here and to sort of, you know, try to show more respect to Chinese history and Chinese culture than the animated original did. And, you know, they won an incredibly rare day-and-day release, so it was supposed to come out in the same time in the United States and China. If they still go ahead with the domestic release in the United States, it will just get pirated all to hell in China, and you sort of blow not just that financial investment, but what was a major, you know, corporate diplomacy effort. And so, I mean, that's – I don't –
Oh, that's a bit – well, that's – yeah, that's a big win, really, as far as I'm concerned. Anything that can disrupt that model and that relationship.
So coronavirus is the real hero. Sonny.
Like, the coronavirus is the real
objectively
hero of this story.
American and I mean, pro American.
It's like, just doing.
This is,
everyone
I just want to make sure I understand
Wuhan, but,
your opinion here.
You know, right. Well, you know, it's plus. There's pluses and minuses. So when some sacrifices will have to be made.
You're saying,
you know,
when this, you die of coronavirus, it will be for American cultural
totally worth
hegemony.
Totally worth it. As long as, you know, the CIA puts a star for me up on the wall, I'll be okay with it. All right. So what do we think here? Is the response from both audiences and Hollywood alike a controversy or a non-troversy when it comes to coronavirus?
I think it's a non-troversy. I think everyone involved appears to be making relatively sensible decisions about what works for public health and their bottom line, and things will probably hopefully return to normal at some point, but doing that is not controversial.
I think that we are going to know whether this is a controversy in 6 or 8 months when No Time to Die comes out and when we see how the coronavirus actually spreads or doesn't and what the impact is globally. I think it's completely possible that there's not a huge impact overall and that it's just James Bond and maybe a little bit of release date tweaking with Mulan next month or this month even when Mulan comes out. But I think it's also possible that the end result of that this is just sort of the first step in a long dance in which global release patterns end up being disrupted and changed as a result of an extended period in which people don't go to the movies or in which lots of people don't go to the movies.
All right. I think it's mostly a non-troversy, but we'll see. I think Peter is right. It's going to be hard to judge until we see whether or not No Time to Die actually bombs at the box office or what.
Now we know what our controversies and non-troversies segment is for the second week of November.
Yeah, for the pre-Thanksgiving episode in 7 months.
We're planning ahead,
I'm
guys.
Write that down. All right. Our main attraction this week is The Way Back, Gavin O'Connor's latest movie about bad dads and the ways in which they can warp our lives, and also the ways in which addiction can warp our lives. Ben Affleck plays an alcoholic struggling to pull it together after the death of his son. He finds redemption in sports, kind of, a common theme from the director of Miracle and Warrior, via a coaching gig with a ragtag group of high school students searching for basketball glory. I saw this movie literally like 30 minutes. I finished watching it about 30 minutes before we started taping this. I have to say I was really impressed by it. I was very much blown away. It is in the tradition of the male weepy sort of movie, you know, about...
And you're a man, right? With tear ducts.
I weep sometimes. Basically anything with dead kids. That's how you get me. So this movie worked very, very much for me. I am curious, Alyssa, if it worked for you.
Like you, I'm affected by dead kid stories since I have a kid who is living and who I'd prefer not to be dead. I will confess, I sat next to Peter in the theater and just sort of kept issuing exasperated snorts of laughter at various points in the movie or leaning over to Peter.
There was some verbal smirking.
There may have been a certain, like, so this is going to happen at this point in the movie, and this is going to happen at this point in the movie, and then it did indeed happen at that point in the movie. I can't say that I think that it's an awful movie, because it's not, but it illustrates something that drives me a little bananas, which is that these kinds of incredibly sentimental, schlocky movies about dad feelings can be treated incredibly seriously, where like Nancy Meyers movies are like fluff and cute, or, I mean, this is basically a Hallmark movie, but in terms of what, you know, the emotional manipulativeness of it and the, you know, just silly obviousness of the writing and the just pure Karo syrup quality of it. But it's a very, you know, it's Ben Affleck, like, having a lot of feelings and working through some stuff. And, you know,
more swearing than in a Hallmark movie.
Yes, there is more cussing. But, you know, because this is about, like, dad feelings, it's treated moderately seriously. Whereas if it was, you know, lady stuff, it would just be like a total confection that wasn't worthy of debate at all. And, you know, it's not ineffective. Affleck is good in it. The, you know, the actors who play the basketball players are quite good. But it's just so obvious and sentimental and silly to a certain extent. Not that, you know, alcoholism is silly, or that, you know, people working through serious issues is, like, that stuff's not silly, but the movie's total predictableness is quite silly.
It's, see, this is an interesting criticism to me, because I thought it did some interesting things that were not predictable. I thought it specifically went out of its way to kind of reject the formula that we expect from these movies, which is being good at sports saves your life and makes you better again. And there's an interesting moment in this movie, spoilers again, the spoilers forever in all these reviews, but there's an interesting moment about 30 minutes before the end of the movie where the team wins the game to send them to the playoffs, and it closes on the slow-mo shot of Ben Affleck kind of smiling and being like, I did it. I brought these guys, you know, to the pinnacle of success. And that is where the movie, that is where this sort of movie fades out 99.9% of times. And it doesn't here. It doesn't here. And instead, it keeps going and it looks beyond what happens in the game. And it looks at the fact that Affleck's character's life is still a mess. It's still a mess. He is still a wreck. He is still emotionally... He's killing his emotions with alcohol, and the thing that actually saves his life at the end of the film is family. It's coming back to the family and getting right with his sister, and his ex-wife, and making amends. I mean, it is almost like an ad for Alcoholics Anonymous,
or like Promise Keepers, or whatever, yeah,
or Promise Keepers or something. I mean, it's a very interesting. I thought that aspect of it was very interesting. Peter, what did you think? You were sitting there with Alyssa. She was snorting away at the male sadness. Cool.
Yeah. So I think I mentioned this on last week's episode. The original title for this film was The Has Been, but I wanted to suggest an alternate title, which was Are Men Okay? The movie, because that's what this is, right? Yeah. This is a movie about the problems of middle-aged men and high school boys and how they're interlinked and how, and in some ways, like one of the things I liked about this movie, which it's not a great movie, but I sort of appreciated it in a lot of ways. And there's some really nice aspects to it. And one of the things it gets right is that high school boys are kind of terrible, and middle-aged men are too, for basically the same reasons, and that when middle-aged men are not terrible, it's mostly because they've managed not to be high school boys and to sort of get past some of that, but it's really hard to do. In fact, some of what this movie reminded me of is my friend Timothy Carney. He's a journalist with the Washington Examiner and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, recently wrote a book titled Alienated America. And the short sort of premise of that book is people need a purpose, and that like when people are upset and sort of distraught and lonely in their lives, that like bad things happen to them. And what you need is to have a community that's local and that's close to you and that gives you a reason to sort of keep going and to connect with other people. And that's what this movie is about. And it is kind of sentimental and it is kind of cheesy. It's also kind of right. And, you know, I want to say this both completely ironically and completely earnestly. Thank you to Gavin O'Connor and Ben Affleck for paying attention to the problems of middle-aged men. Because, in fact, you know, middle-aged men have problems. And like,
we got a lot of problems.
And Ben Affleck.
We got a lot of things we need to
right,
work
like,
out.
Ben Affleck is the vehicle through which we can see our problems worked out on screen.
Well, and I think one of the things that's sort of tricky about this movie is that it is difficult to accept its sincerity separate from the sort of Affleck publicity machine with which it's intensely intertwined, because I simultaneously don't doubt that Ben Affleck has genuinely struggled with alcohol, that he's worked at his recovery and his relationship with his family, and that it is in the interest of his continuing viability as a movie star to kind of sell this sort of redemptive narrative, both about the movie and about himself. And so there is an inherent, I won't say insincerity, but there's an inherent commercialization of the sincerity involved in it that makes the reckoning feel kind of weird. And it's also, I mean, it's a relatively shallow, I mean, movie about that reckoning, right? I mean, one of the things that you said is that it's a movie about how teenage boys are terrible. The teenage boys in this movie are not actually terrible, right? The worst thing, they swear at each other a little bit, like they're a little hot-headed on the basketball court, and one of them like kisses three different girls who like ultimately get to make fun of them. It's like, as a treatment of high school, it's actually quite innocent and sort of disconnected from a lot of the stuff that teenagers are actually going through. The one kid who's, you know, home life you get a sense of outside of school, like he's not, you know, it's his dad, you know, was a promising high school basketball player who like also wants him to potentially like have a trade, be good at school, etc. And then comes around to the idea that like, okay, it's okay if basketball is the thing that like gets him to pay for an education. I mean, that's a, the kids themselves are actually quite sweet for the most part. And the movie is fairly disengaged with their lives outside of basketball. And as
well,
much-
right, because none of them are Ben Affleck. And this movie is about Ben Affleck, and all of them are just there to be Ben Affleck. Sort of like they're there for us to kind of see Ben Affleck through, right?
Right.
They are mirrors, little mirror images of his problems.
But also, I mean, if this is a movie about Ben Affleck, it is a movie that's very scrupulously avoids the harm that he does to other people, right? I mean, there are two really bad things that we see him do to other people on screen in the movie. He shows up late for Thanksgiving dinner, and he, you know, has a minor car accident.
Minor car accident followed by a drunken break-in in which he, I mean, yes.
But the much worse harm he does is to himself,
yes.
Right? And so you don't see any of the things that he actually did to his ex-wife, right? I mean, he apologizes to her for like, you know, I failed my son by not taking care of her mom. But this is not a movie that's ready to reckon in any real way with what actually happened between them. It's basically, it's all off screen. It's basically in the past.
So this is like The Invisible Man, but told from the other side of the story?
I don't think it's that. But the idea that it is, you know, a sincere grappling with either these kids or Ben Affleck's character, it just seems sort of weird to me. And if this were sort of a serious sociological movie about community and American manhood, like, then I would be sort of fine with the way that it's marketed as like kind of very serious and touching. But it's just, it's not that. I don't think you can make a good case for that.
Well, I don't know that I would say that it's that serious a movie. It adopts a tone of seriousness.
Yes, well, and
it's serious about isn't maybe sort of digging deep into these issues.
It's self-serious. It's incredibly self-serious.
It's serious about digging deep into Ben Affleck's star persona.
And his continued desire to be a sympathetic movie star.
No, I one of the things I appreciate about this film is that not everybody is a disastrous mess in it. You have like the two decent priests, which is kind of a rarity in a major motion picture. Like, just like totally decent, like they're just like normal priests.
I actually really like the naturalism of the actors who portrayed them and the way they didn't look. They were not just they didn't look or act like kind of stock characters from a movie. They acted actually like priests or people you might run into at a Catholic high school.
And like the bartender, right, who is like nominally in a way the villain of this movie, who is like setting up drinks for Ben Affleck all the time. It is a very prohibitionist film. This is a shockingly moralizing movie about the dangers of alcohol. And again, this is something that you see in some of O'Connor's other films, like Warrior in particular, that the kind of dangers of addiction and the evils of it. But even the bartender, who again is like nominally, if you have a villain in this movie other than like Ben Affleck's bad side, right, it would be like the people enabling him in this addiction. And they're just guys.
Yeah.
They're just like it, like he's hanging out at the bar with his friends. There's the old man who like takes him home, you know, after his benders. Like he's just a guy helping out. And he's just like, that's what he does. There's something very real to all of this that I found deeply sympathetic and moving.
Yeah. I mean, I think
Both you and I can relate to Ben Affleck's beard in this movie, I feel like.
Yes, I feel for Ben Affleck in his bearded form. That's the thing.
Yeah.
Like post-Batman, you know, beardo.
Yeah, and I guess that I struggle a little bit with the movie's self-seriousness and its sense that it's doing some. I think O'Connor believes this movie is deeper than it is. And
I think that's totally fair.
And it, I mean, it comes through in a lot of the writing. It's, you know, it's a real cheeseball fest, and there's potentially a lot of interesting stuff in this. I mean, among other things, it's a very sympathetic portrait of the way that Catholic high schools have transitioned over time from serving largely white ethnic student populations, many of whom were fleeing increasingly diverse, you know, integrated public schools. And now those schools serve a lot of Black and Latino kids, not all of whom are Catholic, in part because they have stayed and continue to operate in cities where public school systems have deteriorated. And it's not heavy-handed about that at all. But you do sort of see it in the mix of the kids and the transition from, you know, several older generations of white, sort of nominally Irish students and administrators to a very different younger demographic. And that's sort of done unshowily and in a way that's like reasonably interesting, if not terribly detailed. I think there is some interesting stuff going on with the tension between Affleck's character and the team chaplain over like what it is that they're doing with the boys and what they're supposed to be teaching them. But it's all a little half-baked.
I mean, do you guys think that Ben Affleck's character would have been able to stop drinking if he'd had the help of a CGI dog from The Call of the Wild?
Only if that dog was like stealing the pints of vodka out of his hand and like hiding them in the back alley. All right, so what do we think, guys? Thumbs up or thumbs down on the way back?
I mean, thumbs up for dads who will watch it on long flights and be like try to conceal their tears from their seatmates.
I'll give it a thumbs up. I think I have to. It's like I said, it's not a great movie, but. But I didn't mind watching it in some ways.
Strong thumbs up. Strong thumbs up. It was, in fact, a great movie and a great dad movie. All right. This week's assigned viewing is the Jean-Claude Van Damme, John Woo pairing Hard Target. Peter, why are we watching this movie about a Cajun martial artist who punches snakes unconscious?
Because it's awesome. No, we're watching it to set up The Hunt, which is another movie that takes the kind of a premise from The Most Dangerous Game, which is that rich people get to pay to hunt poor people. And that movie is going to be coming out in just a week or so. And this is another movie based on that same idea. This is a 1993 action film. Like you said, it's directed by John Woo. This is not only John Woo's first U.S. film, it is the first major Hollywood studio film ever to be directed by a Chinese director. It got middling reviews at the time, but it became hugely influential in its own way, helped bring Hong Kong action to the United States, all that balletic slow motion stuff, you know, sort of the I'm like spinning around with two guns while doves like fly behind me, like in perfect synchronous, you know, all of that stuff, which we see then in films like The Matrix. This was, you know, also just in that it was the first time that a big studio took a risk on a Chinese director who at the time didn't speak very good English. In fact, his English was so bad that they actually had put Sam Raimi on the set and said, basically, if John Woo can't make this movie work, then you have to step in and be the actual director. And so this is an important step towards the world of global cinema that we see now that is being disrupted by the coronavirus. You could say in some ways that Mulan might not exist if Jean-Claude Van Damme had never punched that snake. It is ultra-violent. It is Sort of incredibly exaggerated. It's also very moody and romantic in a way that's extremely your sort of Hong Kong influence. Wu draws a lot from classic American Westerns as well as movie musicals. He's a big fan of musicals. You can see that in the way he stages his fight scenes, which are designed to show off the physicality of his actors and the ways that they move together, right? They're almost, they're punching each other and shooting each other, but they're almost dancing through these sets. I think I really like this movie. I'm not sure it's a great movie, but it's a very strong action film. And it's so interesting to watch now that, in retrospect, in which all of the stuff that Wu was doing was very original and actually off-putting to a lot of American audiences at the time, but now has just been completely absorbed into American cinema and really is in a lot of ways the kind of – it defines what great action is in a way that I think a lot of critics in particular did not recognize or see at the time.
Alyssa, did you prefer the slow motion – shots of doves flying in the background for no reason, or the slow motion shot of Jean-Claude? This is my favorite shot in the movie because it's so dumb and pointless. The slow motion shot of Jean-Claude Van Damme like walking out of the diner where he has seen the woman be harassed and realizes that the guys are going to steal her money from her.
I mean, they're going to try to rape her.
Just like, for
yes.
No reason.
No, there is a reason. It's to emphasize that this is a moment of decision in which we are going to see a test of Jean-Claude Van Damme's character, of Chance Boudreau's character. And we're going to find out what kind of a man he is. And he's the kind of man who walks in slow motion right before he uses his incredible kickboxing skills to take out a bunch of bad guys.
Cajun is something else. Alyssa, what did you make of Hard Target?
It's so weird. I'm sorry, it's just so strange. But it's also, I mean, given the global pedigree of this movie, it's also just fascinating that it is so specifically about Louisiana, right? I mean, you have a several-minute exchange about the status of Chance Boudreau's union membership, right?
Well, so this is also a throwback to when a lot of middle-budget, star-driven action films not a throwback, but from the era when a lot of middle-budget, star-driven action films were about blue-collar, working-class men. And in fact, John Woo wanted Kurt Russell to play the lead. Jean-Claude Van Damme was the studio's choice. Russell was booked up for 2 years, and so John Woo ended up going with Jean-Claude Van Damme and ended up rebuilding a bunch of the action scenes in order to sort of emphasize the fact that Van Damme's not a great actor, but he's a great physical screen presence who can stand on a motorcycle that is being rammed towards a truck filled with henchmen who are shooting at you, and then, like, somehow or another, crash the motorcycle into the truck, leap over it, do a backflip, turn around, shoot things, and have everything. It's so cool. It's just so cool. And that's one of the things I love about this movie, is that it doesn't ask, does this make sense? It never asks that question. It only asks the question, does this look awesome? And the answer that John Woo provides is always, yes.
No, I mean,
and that is why you have Wilford Brimley riding a horse, shooting arrows at Lance Henriksen. Fire.
Brimley is in this movie.
If Wilford Brimley does not ride a horse, does John Wick eventually ride a horse through Manhattan, shooting people on motorcycles? I have no idea, but I'm going to assume, for purposes of this conversation, that the answer is no, and that the world would be a poorer place for it. No, I do think the sort of specific regionalism of the movie is genuinely kind of fascinating, especially given that Hollywood tends not to be very interested in places outside of major metropolitan areas unless it is, you know, painting blue-collar Southerners as hicks or doing, you know, very romanticized, like Reese Witherspoon goes back to Sweet Home Alabama, or, you know, True Detective Southern Gothic. And so the fact that it is kind of set in this environment, has this, you know, totally absurd premise. It almost reminds me of watching a Baz Luhrmann movie, right? And that there are all of these sort of tonal oddities.
It's a musical. Yes. It's a highly stylized musical about romance and about the putting something beautiful on screen. It's actually interesting. The screenwriter said he said it in Louisiana to explain Jean-Claude Van Damme's accent. That was it. But it's also, but, and yet he decided to actually go through with setting it in Louisiana, not just sort of like having it be a backdrop. It's actually part of the story. Yeah. And it, and you think about this in the context of the current environment for shooting movies on location. Louisiana, we see Louisiana on screen a lot in the last decade or so because Louisiana has some of the biggest film tax credits in the country. Now, they've been reduced a little bit over the past couple of years, but it's not an accident that you see all of these films that are either set there or even something like White House Down. They rebuilt the White House lawn in Louisiana because it was just cheaper to do it there than, say, build it on a soundstage in Hollywood or in Vancouver or something. And so we've seen Louisiana a lot, but it tends not to kind of come through as we set this movie in this place because we wanted it to feel like this place. It tends to come through as like, well, this was the place where they'd give us 20% of our money back. And so it's just interesting to see it as like an experiment in actually like adding a little bit of localism and sort of local flavor, right? A Cajun hotness to a Hong Kong action film, which makes it also much weirder, but I kind
of
love it.
And sort of charming. It's also really interesting. My eyes sort of perked up when, you know, they're doing the title credit sequence and Kazi Lemon's name pops up as the police officer who ends up embroiled in all of this because she takes the missing persons report about the veteran who's been hunted for sport. And Lemons is a really interesting director. I don't know if you guys have watched any of her movies, but she's best known for Eves Bayou, which is about a Creole American community in Louisiana, but a Black Creole American community. And for a movie that she directed that's actually really terrific, is Talk to Me, which is about Petey Green, who was a Washington, D.C. radio talk show host, who ended up playing a sort of an important role in shaping the mood of the city during the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And so it's kind of, there's something fascinating about the fact that she ended up in this movie, given that she is, you know, has turned out to be, after she sort of walked away from her acting career, this very fascinating interpreter of the Black Southern experience. And so the fact that she's in this Hong Kong martial arts movie set in Louisiana is just sort of a nifty bit of film history. I know her better as a director than as an actor, and it was sort of fun to see her pop up in this.
The thing I wanted to ask you guys about was, what did you make of this film's politics? Because we're watching this in preparation for The Hunt, and The Hunt has been not rebranded, but after delaying the release last year, they have changed the advertising for this film to emphasize that it is a political satire because it's about rich blue state liberals, paying to hunt red state conservatives, and so there's going to be some sort of thing about political polarization. We haven't seen the movie yet, so we can't say exactly what. But that's clearly where that film is going. And this I thought was interesting in that it's not a political satire. It's not a particularly political film. And yet there are these bits in it that really kind of play into a what feels like a very contemporary narrative of inequality, in which, in particular, I can't remember whether it's the Lance Henriksen bad guy or the Arnold Vosloo bad guy. One of the two main bad guys explains to one of the rich guys who's paying to hunt a human, right? Like gives him the, you know what, you're better than them. You have the resources. This is a thing that like that you can do that very few people can do. And you know what, that like, they're going to like you're going to enjoy this, and right, and like kind of gives them a moral right, tries to sort of make them innocent in this incredible sort of moral travesty that they're participating in. And then again, when you see the scene that I thought was even better, actually a nicely written scene, when again one of the head bad guys comes to a vet who is going to be the target, mm-hmm. and offers him $10,000 and talks about what, right, it's if what you escape, you can have this $10,000 and you can be somebody who can
you can clean yourself up, you can buy
new clothes, you can like sort of carry yourself as a man again, mm-hmm. and it's actually in these two little scenes, there's like this kind of interesting little commentary. First, on the idea that like inequality as a political issue is not something brand new that we just started talking about with Thomas Piketty, but that these systems sort of work to sort of rob people of their dignity and also to morally justify heinous acts by those who have more resources.
Well, and I think it's also the case that, I mean, this movie is simultaneously something that kind of works in today's political environment and yet is very specific to its time, right? I mean, there is, the Vietnam War is never explicitly mentioned, but this movie comes out in 1993 and it's clear that these guys are Vietnam veterans who are not doing terribly well. I think that's the fairly clear implication. And, you know, there was a, you know, very, America had a lot of trouble dealing with Vietnam veterans and with the trauma that they represented. And so, you know, this movie is highly specific to a sense that Vietnam veterans were struggling. I mean, all of these guys who are hunted are homeless vets, and they are chosen specifically because they, you know, they are dysfunctional enough to accept these offers, but they have training that makes them formidable and interesting quarry. And so, you know, the movie is very rooted in this very particular sort of post-Vietnam detail. And these men are being exploited by these sort of globetrotting elites. You know, there's this another scene between the lead henchman and one of their clients where they, you know, they keep talking about where they're going to shift their base of operations, where they've been doing business. You know, they're just sort of here in the United States for a while to exploit, you know, working class veterans and, you know, veterans who are genuinely poor, and then move on to their next base of operations where there's little regulation. And so, I mean, it's a movie that to a certain extent feels like it's sort of a trade, like early 90s trade anxiety. It's about...
And in fact, the screenwriter was a Navy SEAL, so has it wasn't that himself.
Vietnam. I mean, it's just, it's... And one of the measures of whether a movie lasts in a lot of cases is whether it is specific enough to be interesting, but general enough to feel engaging in an entirely different set of political circumstances that sort of twang the same strings. And I mean, so I, it feels both, this movie feels both specific to a particular era that is past and that in some ways does not bear a lot of resemblance to the environment we're in right now, and also totally portable in a way that's kind of fascinating.
There is nothing more interesting than Jean-Claude Van Damme jump kicking in slow motion in front of a warehouse, flaming warehouse full of like clown paraphernalia.
Oh, well, it's like Mardi Gras stuff.
Mardi Gras floats while doves fly up in the background. Yeah. I think it's the most interesting thing I've ever seen.
It's a universal image.
That and Ben Affleck's beard.
For my two cents, I agree with Peter that the real heroes of this movie are the wealthy people trying to help the homeless get back on their feet. It was very, very nice of them. All right, our next assigned viewing will be Ip Man, which we will watch in preparation for Mulan, assuming, of course, that Disney does not pull Mulan from the release schedule over the next couple weeks here. That is it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Before we go, I'd just like to give our loyal and growing audience a heads up. We are taking next week off, mostly so Alyssa and Peter can find a new host after I pull a Gwyneth Paltrow in Contagion. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow a podcast such as this. And if we don't grow, we'll die. You don't want us to die, do you? I mean, I might die from the virus anyway, but you never know.
This will be the Sunny Bunch Memorial podcast.
The memorial in memoriam next week, Sunny Bunch, I guess 2 weeks from now. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sunny Bunch. I will convince you that it is in fact the best show on your podcast feed. See you guys next week after next.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Pasetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.